Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined on this rather cold, and in Joburg at least, slightly sort of drizzly day by Mr. Michael Morrison, Cape Town. Michael, how are you doing?
Yeah, very well, thank you. I'm pleased to say it's not even slightly drizzly here in Cape Town, when it probably should be, being our winter. It's quite sunny and pleasant.
As usual, Cape Town sends us their bad weather. yeah. We have to suffer it. And of course, in I think you're in Polokwane, are you, Tiego?
Mr. Tiego? Yeah, I'm in Polokwane. How are you doing? And it's drizzling. No, I'm doing good things. And how are you, Nick, sir? Good afternoon, Michael, sir.
Hi, Tiego.
Yeah, so anyway, it looks like the rest of the country is having to suffer the terrible weather of Cape Town. But anyway, thank you for that, Michael. all right, before we get into the show, I want to get back to our sponsor for this week and also for next week, and that is Bitvice. So a word from them: Bitcoin is a complete hedge against the global debasement of money, inflation, and government overreach. Bitvice is a South Africa-first, Bitcoin-only self-custody solution that helps individuals and entities buy and hold Bitcoin for the long term. Bitvice believes that everyone should hold their own Bitcoin and trust no one else. Recently, there have been a plethora of crypto custodians going bankrupt, taking their Bitcoin with them. This is why Bitvice never holds your Bitcoin. They send it immediately to your Bitcoin wallet where you hold the keys. Not your keys, not your coins. Simply sign up to Bitvice, link your bank account securely, and buy Bitcoin in seconds. Visit bitvice.io and begin your journey in buying and securing the scarcest asset that mankind has ever created. All right. Well, it seems we've lost Michael. He's disconnected. Anyway, hopefully he'll be back. Sure. But we have, for the first topic today, a thing that has raised quite a lot of ire, I think, sort of around in the country's middle class. And this is Eskom tariffs, and more specifically, so not only are we getting an increase in, welcome back, Michael, an increase in electricity prices, but Eskom looks like it might also be charging people for solar panels. So if you have a solar panel that's not connected to the Eskom grid, you're probably going to be charged for it as well. And this could be as much as 938 rand a month based on the new tariff structure. But there's still a little bit of unclarity about this, and Eskom hasn't confirmed all of the details yet. But I'm sure we will see all of the details soon. Anyway, this has provoked quite a lot of outrage from various sectors of the country. A lot of people, you know, have switched to having solar panels either for green reasons. They want to be more environmentally conscious. Other people have switched to it to try and reduce their reliance on Eskom generally. And some people are gambling that it will end up being less cost effective, although that question is much more debatable. So one of the people leveling this criticism at Eskom was Melanie Fofout, who's normally, you know, she's a former ANC MP, and she's normally kind of, I would say, fairly in step with the sort of News 24 mainstream view of things, but she was very upset, saying that she had switched to solar panels precisely because they were a green alternative and she wanted to reduce the load on Eskom. And now she looked like she was going to be charged for it. And this was showing that the government's desire to put, or stated desire to put, more independent electricity producers on the grid was all hot air and hollow promises. And she was hoping that Eskom would reverse this decision. I believe the words she used in her column were, "Are you freaking kidding me?" Eskom, for their part, said, "This isn't about the intention is not to disincentivize households from opting for solar panels and reducing their reliance on the grid," the power utility said. "The intent of the fixed cost for an Eskom connection is not to disincentivize the use of solar power at all. It is to ensure adequate recovery of costs. There needs to be an evolution in the thinking of how fixed costs can be recovered in tariffs," which is not what I would call the purest English statement out there, but anyway. So let me start with you, Michael. You had some thoughts on this one, firstly about sort of the politics of who's criticizing this decision, but also about the decision in general. What do you make?
I think, I mean, on the first point, I think there are kind of two issues. The one is the broadly political one. And in that sense, I think it's very interesting for somebody like Melania Favut, who's tended, you know, she's not uncritical, but she's tended always to project a fairly generous
interpretation. Right, she's been sympathetic to the ANC.
Sympathetic of the ANC. But I think what we're seeing here is something we've touched on the show before, and I know Two Crickets has also, is what we're seeing increasingly is this much more candid, no holds barred approach to public comment and criticism. And I think this is certainly an example. There was another very striking one just a few days ago, Justice Malala writing, I think, in the Sunday Times with the headline, "We've run out of good reasons to keep ANC in power. The rest is blackmail." So, I mean, that gives you an idea of the sort of tempo or the tenor of so much of the debate that we're seeing. And that's really very healthy. It's also obviously very healthy that we're having a thorough conversation about electricity generation, power generation, and so on. And that, to me, is the second issue. And I think this one may, in fact, be a little more complex than it might at first appear. It's possible, in fact, that this particular issue, this tariff that Eskom is now seeking approval for, might help to introduce what I'd be inclined to think of as a greater measure of realism about the debate about energy production, and particularly the green versus carbon streams of thinking. I half feel that I'm not clever enough or not clued up enough about this to really contribute a great deal to the debate. And I know that Andrew Kenny and some of our other colleagues have written about the very considerable or the considerably higher cost of green energy as opposed to the conventional coal-fired and certainly nuclear energy. And people have tended not to really, I don't think, come to grips with this, that it is, you know, it's an episodic supply of power from these things, green, and it's wonderful. And so I actually don't especially like these vast glimmering areas of photovoltaic cells and these huge windmills despoiling the landscape, in my view. But I can appreciate that it's cleaner, it doesn't smell awful and so on as so many of the other systems of generation do. But it's episodic, and apparently it's quite expensive to link it into a grid system, and it costs. So what we have now is Eskom seeming to say that all they're doing with this tariff is actually just acknowledging or working these real costs into the tariff. You made a reference to the quality of the phrasing of the Eskom statement. It's a pity that it isn't just spelled out in plain language what exactly they're talking about, because it's all a bit jargony and euphemistic. But it does seem to me that it's a bit more complicated. It doesn't necessarily seem that it's about stopping people from doing the good thing and you know, putting up cleaner energy sources. There does seem to be this real issue of how much it costs, that it is just a different cost structure from the conventional energy generating systems.
So, Tiago, firstly, your thoughts on what Michael's just said, but also, you know, in a certain sense, I do feel sort of for municipalities and for Eskom, in that they're kind of trapped in a bit of a death spiral here, right? If, you know, half the country went off the grid tomorrow, we wouldn't have load shedding. But the downside of that would be, of course, that half of their potential revenue would evaporate overnight, and Eskom is, shall we say, not in a great financial position currently, being overstaffed and struggling to, they have made some successes, I think, in reducing their debt recently, but it's still sitting, you know, somewhere between, I think, 300 and 400 billion rand. So, you know, they really are in a bit of a horns of the dilemma here, which is that it's difficult for them to fix, to the sort of deeper infrastructure problems and build new capacity if they can't generate more revenue, but at the same time, they can't generate revenue because people don't trust the supply and want to get off it. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, my thoughts are that any company that exists with a particular purpose, right? And the particular purpose in this instance of Eskom is to provide electricity to people, and it has failed to provide electricity in a thorough manner, where if people then find solutions to generating electricity themselves, let them generate electricity themselves. And if that means Eskom collapsing, let it collapse. Why does it have to exist if it's not serving its purpose? And it doesn't make logical sense that people are being punished for finding solutions to the electricity crisis in their households. I think we have quite an abusive government here. It really doesn't make sense, and I think it's an abuse of power on the side of Eskom. Really, we as citizens, we as individuals in this country, we're not born in some way linked or forced to buy electricity from Eskom. If we can find ways of generating that electricity ourselves, I think that's a route we should take, and the Eskom should stop with the abuse. Sure. And I apologize quite a lot. My brain is not working very well today. I'm recovering from sleep.
I've had a lot recently as well. I know the feeling. I do think that this is part of I do agree with you to a certain extent that this is really kind of part of the problem, is that we all forced into this position where Eskom lives at the center of our electricity life, so to speak. We can't really get rid of it. It's like we're in a bad marriage and we sort of just have to find out a solution. And I agree with you that divorce is looking very attractive from Eskom, but I do worry that if we hasten the collapse of Eskom too much, there won't necessarily be anything in the way to replace it, at least in the short term. Although, I don't know. Michael, final thoughts from you. What do you think?
I should have mentioned this earlier, but there's a very good piece on the Daily Friend today, our main opinion piece by Jonathan Katz and Ellenbogen, precisely about what to do. You know, we've now dwelled on the extent of the crisis for weeks and weeks, he turns the attention on what we can do. And one of the points he makes is even with an emergency plan, we're likely to face load shedding for at least the next decade. I mean, this is really quite a striking dose of tough reality. But his last paragraph I thought was very interesting. He says, while many homeowners have resorted to solar panels and batteries, it could be far more efficient for neighborhoods to produce their own power at scale. Sheer desperation could soon push neighborhoods to make a plan with or without government permission. And then he adds, I think tellingly, and the government itself might just turn a blind eye to those who do so without permission. And yeah, isn't this true of so much of the way we do things in the countries? We're just kind of getting on with it, and whatever we're almost ignoring what the law says, what we're strictly allowed to do or not allowed to do, or who's supposed to do it, we just get on with it. Just kind of privatize all these things and bring them down to household and, as he suggests, neighborhood level.
You know, that's a good point, is that, you know, there comes a certain point when government just won't get any more chances, and people are going to do what they're going to do. And I think that is actually a pretty South African trait in general, is that, you know, we mark a plan. Anyway, okay, let's move on to our next topic for today. And this is a dispute once again between, we've talked about this is a theme that keeps coming up again and again in light of the horrible public crimes in Cape Town, but there is of course this ongoing dispute between the central government and the Western Cape with regards to the extent that the police should be decentralized. The central government and police minister Biggie Gwele says that it's against the constitution to decentralize the police too much into the provinces, whereas the Western Cape provincial government says that this is not unconstitutional at all and is necessary to get crime under control in various areas, particularly because, of course, they're controlled by two different political parties. So neither wants the other one to control the situation. Part of this debate has centered around what to do with illegal firearms. So, of course, there are an enormous number, we talked about it on the show yesterday, of illegal firearms in South Africa. And government is not always great at getting them and keeping them safe, but still a fair amount are recovered. And what these are supposed to happen to these is these are supposed to be transported to a location where they are all melted down and destroyed so that they are removed from circulation. Currently, the system works in that there's only one place in the country where you are allowed to do this, and that is a central place in Pretoria where all firearms twice a year have to be transported to across the country so that they can be destroyed, which means that they sit for a fair amount of time in the provinces before they are transported to the central location where they can be vulnerable to theft, to corrupt dealings that get them sold off to gangsters once again or something of that nature. So the Western Cape government has asked the police, they asked them various questions about what the downsides of transporting guns to the central arms destruction location is. And the provincial police commissioner for the Western Cape, Tepisile Pakiile, said that this was a serious matter that was fairly high risk to transport these firearms across the country. The transportation of firearms is costly and of high risk, they said in their reply to the Western Cape government. So in return for this, the Western Cape has asked for their own firearms destruction facility to be constructed but that will need the permission of national government. The deputy police minister has responded to saying, there's no need for things to happen in certain provinces. And we will look into that. We are open to engagements on that. I can confidently say, however, that the Western Cape has received more resources than any other provinces. Tiako, what do you make of this? It seems once again that, governments may be leaving the door a little bit open here, at least national government, to decentralizing a bit, but all the incentives seem to be against it. What do you make of this discussion?
Well, I think we are dealing with an arrogant government here. We know quite well the kind of government we're dealing with here. I think it's a deliberate thing. They deliberately do not want to see the Western Cape's police succeeding in any way. They wouldn't want to give them power. They enjoy this whole thing of crime being high that side and everything and everyone being blamed for it. And the reality of the matter is that many people on the ground don't understand that the police are a national project that's not handled by provinces and staff. So it assists them to a certain extent in places like Khayelitsha, whereby ordinary people, they don't understand that the province is not in charge of the police. So the ANC in such areas, I kid you not, because they are always lying when they're on the ground lying. When they are on the ground campaigning, they are always lying. So they most probably even just say that it's because of the Western Cape that the crime situation is not being dealt with that side. But more than anything, I think it's an issue of incompetence on the part of the police. We have discussed this before, that the government of the day, at least at the national level, really, really many of the people in there don't know what they are doing. And for the most part, they are not competent at all. They couldn't care less if guns are stolen or not. A lot of times what they are after is just money. And some of those guns that are stolen at police stations, you find that the people who are stealing these guns are connected to them. So you could very well find that it's a deliberate thing because they make money out of this. I think it's a realization that South Africans must come to, that we are these days dealing with an African National Congress that's not really a political party anymore, but a criminal syndicate. And so even when we analyze situations such as this one, we should try to see how the whole thing benefits them. They are probably benefiting from this whole thing. Probably it's probably even gonna assist them with their conference at the end of the year. We might find that they are stealing some of the guns and stealing and selling them and using the money towards a conference. That's the ANC that we are dealing with today. It's a trade a criminal syndicate. That's my general take around the matter, sure.
Yeah, I do agree with you. The shall we say the police have not given us, particularly on the care of illegally of seized firearms, to trust them a lot. And of course, we've seen a famous case where a police officer in the Western Cape faced charges relating specifically to selling. It was firearms that had been handed in by civilians for destruction to gangsters, which is just completely outrageous. Anyway, Michael, your thoughts once again with seeing this tension between centralization and decentralization.
Yeah, I mean, I think all those political points are absolutely valid. It is. I mean, it is striking. On the other hand, that, you know, here we have a commissioner, a police commissioner, particularly in the Western Cape, you know, warning that it's costly and it's a high risk, and his own deputy minister turns around and kind of makes excuses as to why a solution can't be found, and you know, clearly, especially in the Western Cape, where gangsterism is such a major problem, and where, as Diego has pointed out, you know, there's this leaky situation where weapons that belong to the state end up in the hands of highly violent and people who are, you know, whose competition among themselves is invariably plays out in very violent ways. It's just ridiculous that one of the things you fail to do is look at how to do, you know, find any way to reduce the risk of these weapons going into the wrong hands. So yeah, there's plenty of room for cynicism. It's kind of encouraging in a way that you have, as I say, you have this the regional commissioner making this warning, it coming from the cops, but very disappointing that appeal is not being taken seriously.
Indeed, but I also do like the fact that this is, you know, sort of, I guess, decentralization one step at a time. So obviously the Western Cape would like the whole system to be more decentralized. But if you're politically trying to do something like this, I think this is a pretty good way of doing it. You find a very specific issue where it's really clear that this would be helpful. There's, and then you just press on that one. And maybe they make some progress there. Diego, any final thoughts before we move on to our next topic?
Sure. No, my final thoughts around the matter would be that I think decentralization would work quite well. When the work is divided, how do I say it? How do the left actually say it? Or they always speak of a division of labor. That's what Karl Marx and the others are always talking about. Division of labor is quite helpful. Then there's a shorter chunk of work for one to focus on, and you can keep track of what that person is doing. So if we do decentralize and the Western Cape is in charge of the police, we can then measure how hard they are working in the province and stuff of that nature. So I do hope that eventually we do get to that point. But with the ANC still at national level, I don't think we'll see that happening. I think they enjoy deliberately sabotaging the province since it's not governed by them. But yeah, I hope that come 2024, as things move forward, we'll see a bit of changes moving forward, sure.
Well, I think that's likely to happen as the country's political climate gets, shall we say, more interesting. But just a last point on decentralization, you know, South Africa's a pretty big place. With quite different circumstances, and it does seem like having a police that can specialize themselves for, say, Gauteng, which is mostly urban, as compared to, you know, KZN, where a lot of the crime happens in sort of Durban, but also in rural areas. It's a different environment, and so decentralization would, I suspect, help find solutions to crime problems. Anyway, so our next topic for today is about the much beloved and much scorned, depending on where you stand with regards to politics, social relief of distress grant. This was introduced during COVID-19 as a kind of measure to help people who had been hurt by the devastation to the economy that happened during the lockdowns. It's a grant of 350 rand a month. So not a lot of money, but, you know, certainly enough to get by. There's been, shall we say, some bad things that have happened with it for sure. Like I believe there was a government official who was reported to SASSA. Despite earning 1 million rand a year, he was collecting the 350 rand grant, which is just insanity. And at the time of the reporting, nothing had been done about it by SASSA. But hopefully that's been rectified since. The Department of Social Development, however, is looking at increasing the number of recipients of the social relief distress grant by raising the income threshold from 350 rand. So if you earn 350 rand currently, you qualify to 624 rand per month. This, they say, is in line with the poverty line income test and will give more people access to the grant. They say that up till now, they've been paying about 5.2 million people this grant. And they want to reach 10 million people with the grant because they reckon that that's how many people are in need of it. So they reckon that including more people in that sort of space between 350 rand a month and 624 rand a month will help them to achieve that goal. Michael, obviously, you know, a lot of people don't have work opportunities, so this is for them a pretty big deal. But at the same time, this is starting to feel not only permanent, but something that's growing.
Yeah, I mean, it is a worrying thing. The kind of habitual dependence on a state that, in fact, appears to be running out of money and certainly isn't managing the economy in such a way as to guarantee a steady and increasing flow of income, of revenue for its own social program. So the social program, on its merits, is absolutely fine. I was looking at a story this morning saying that out of 11.4 million applicants for the month of June, as you said, only 5.2 million beneficiaries were approved. This represents less than 50% of the applications. So clearly, there is this huge need, and we know this. You know, massive unemployment. People are really battling post COVID, post Ukraine invasion. All these things are contriving to make life really, really difficult. But the longer term, or even the medium term outlook of this assistance is itself in doubt, because we are pursuing policies which are in fact undermining the integrity of this kind of system, the feasibility of it, the feasibility of actually helping our own people. It does underscore more than anything else the essential requirement of a policy shift that is going to turn the economy around, generate jobs, reduce this this dependence on the state. I mean, people are dependent on whoever they can turn to, and so it's not, you know, one's objective is not to punish those who through no fault of their own are really battling, but it's not a help simply to accept that we've got to continue helping them without doing anything else to create jobs and generate economic growth. So that's, yeah, it underscores this fundamental truth about South Africa.
So, Tiego, I know you are not a fan of government dependency, and I know you're also not a fan of big spending by government. But is there not a argument that in a situation where you have almost half the country unemployed, that something like this might, at least in the short term, be a reasonable policy solution? What do you make of it?
Well, perhaps it might be, but I think I think we should go a bit deeper, right? Unemployment is high, but my own personal belief, I believe that even when unemployment is high, people should still be willing to work. You don't have to be employed to work. Many of the people who are on this social grant are from rural areas in South Africa. Rural areas in South Africa, majority of people still have farming land, for example. Why are they not using that farming land? Why are they not raising food, selling food and whatever, really? But people must work and not wait for employment. And the other thing is that government cannot sustain this whole thing that it's doing. We cannot continue giving people money, distributing money in this way. People people have to work. We have to go back to that. And this thing of distributing money in this way is really frustrating quite a lot. You go to areas such as Burgersfort here in Limpopo, there's so much land that people could use to raise food and stuff of that nature. It's not being used at all. So I do think that we are spoiling our people to a large extent. And that has to come to an end, really. The people must know that they have to, if you are going to eat at the end of the day and you have hands and you have food and you have your feet and you have your head and everything, you have to work for that thing, employed or not employed. Let's assist those who really, really, really are not physically able to provide for themselves. But for people such as those in rural areas who have the land, who have the resources because they do have the seats and stuff, but they are simply not using them. If they starve, I'm going to sound brutal right now, but if they do starve, let them starve because they are starving because they are lazy to work. It's not our concern. It shouldn't be a concern.
Diego, I I've heard it before, but I'll say it again. People do compliment you on your blunt approach to these things. I must say, sure, go ahead.
No, I was just about to say that. No. It's simply, I think it's just the truth, man. I think people have gotten used to this. I think post 1994, actually, since 1994, I think there were a lot of promises. And since 1994, everyone seems to be relaxing and they are waiting on someone to come, some messiah to come and save them, provide them with food, provide them with money and stuff of that nature. But that's not how a real life works. In real life, you have to work if you want to eat at the end of the day. So, rural areas have land. People must go and work. That's it, really.
So I'm sort of sympathetic to both points of view, and I you know, part of the reason is because when you know I talk to like Zimbabweans, for example, they say, "Wait, the government builds a house for you? What?" And this is just sort of beyond like how can you the sort of implications? How can you be so sort of lazy? And I do think it's a real problem when you have literally generations of people who just think that like who are stuck in unemployment and they don't know anyone with a job or they know maybe one person with a job. And I do think that there could be a problem there where you literally raise children who have never seen an adult with sort of steady employment or steady work or steady operations in their life. And I think the social consequences of that can be pretty hectic. But at the same time, you know, I would be more sympathetic to the view that people should be working if we gave everyone free land tenure, if we gave everyone private property rights over the land they live on, because I think that would create a lot of economic incentives to work exactly. But anyway, we're out of time. This is we maybe should have done this topic earlier because I think there's a lot to say about it. But anyway, that's all we have time for today. We hope that you enjoyed the show. And we will see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Have a great one, everyone. Cheers.